The known universe, with its heroes and marvels. But what of the darkness? In our modern world, this is where monsters dwell.
And welcome back to the Tomb of Ideas, a Marvel horror podcast. My name is James Hickson.
I'm Trey Lawson.
And that's all we've got time for, guys, because we have to really get... it's true. We really got to get into these next comics because we've got, what is it, 5 issues to talk about?
Yeah. The modern comics, man. You got a bunch of issues per story arc.
Yeah, but that's not the only reason we have to rush. And, man, I'm glad I had that caffeine. We also have to... We thought caffeine was bad last episode. Oh, boy, I've had so much more caffeine this episode. It's great. But we also have to, you know, make time because we only have the first half of the episode to talk about them. Because we have a very special guest.
That's right. We did it.
Wait, we got the queen? Wait.
No.
I see. So who did we get? Wait, Freddie Mercury? Wait, no. Who did we get?
We got... comics creator, screenwriter, novelist, Paul Cornell of course, Captain Britain and MI-13, which we have been talking about and will continue to talk about, but also Knight and Squire, Wisdom, Action Comics, Saucer Country, Doctor Who, you name it. This guy has done a little bit of everything, and we are really thrilled to be able to chat with him about his Marvel work, along with some other things that he has been involved in more recently.
Really, really, really excited. Again, hopefully I come down from the caffeine high by then. But as discussed last episode, we are continuing with our look at Captain Britain and MI-13. We are looking at the Hell Comes to Birmingham arc from that book, which means we are looking at Captain Britain and MI-13 number 5, number 6, number 7, number 8, and number 9.
Right. So out of this 15-issue run, this is sort of the middle section.
Yeah.
Act 2.
Exactly. If you are reading the trade paperbacks, it is trade paperback 2, basically.
Right.
Yeah. So, without further ado, we're going to go ahead and take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be looking at the first half. I think we talked about this. The first 3 issues...
Right.
Because we have little time to talk about these in, so
sure.
We're not doing individual issues like we've done before. We are kind of clumping them all together, taking care of those, and then discussing that, and then coming back in to talk about the next part.
Right. So for this first segment after the break, if you're reading along with us, we're looking at issues 5, 6, and 7.
Exactly. And if you're not following all that, well, coffee helps. Lots and lots of coffee.
Okay, I'm going to try and bring James down a little bit. He's bouncing off the walls. While I do that, everyone listen to these trailers, and we'll be right back.
Whee! When the moon is full, when things which should stay hidden make themselves known, and the creatures of the shadows walk among us.
There'll be no morning for us.
Then you're watching The Shillers, The Hammer House of Horror, 10 classic tales of terror from the famous British movie studio of the macabre. First, a trio of Frankensteins starring Peter Cushing.
I'll give you life again.
The Curse of Frankenstein.
Don't you see you've created a monster?
Frankenstein must be destroyed, and the revenge of Frankenstein. A mythic monster turns hearts to stone in the Gorgon. Joan Fontaine unearths sinister secrets in the Devil's Ohm. Then those lips, those eyes, those telltale marks. Christopher Lee creates his most famous role in Dracula, Prince of Darkness.
Let me kiss you.
and Dracula has risen from the grave. Plus Christopher Lee in The Terror of the Tongs.
Have you ever had your bones scraped?
There's something evil in them.
The dead awake to stalk the living in The Mummy.
It will kill us! It will kill us, all of us!
And The Curse of the Mummy's Tomb. Chillers, The Hammer House of Horror, 10 classic tales of grisly ghouls and gothic terror, this month on Cinemax. And accept an invitation to a nightmare when you join host Christopher Lee each weeknight, October 28th through November 8th, for a terrifying journey into the unknown.
I'll be waiting for you.
If you take two old punk rockers who are past their prime, put them in front of a movie screen, and give them a podcast, what do you get? Cinema Punks. Cinepunks. It's the mixtape of movies.
Welcome back, Tomb Believers. We are looking at the first issue of this story arc. Of course, this is the Hell Comes to Birmingham story arc from Captain Britain and MI-13. Again, that is issues 5 through 9. We're looking at 5, 6, and 7 here. And the first issue, number 5, is Prologue. And penciler... Sorry, writer on this one, of course, is Paul Cornell. Penciler is Pat Olaf, which... does my old Spider-Girl subscribing heart proud and happy. Colorists are Brian Reber and Raul Triv. Inker is Paul Neary. Letterer is VC's Joe Caramagna. Assistant editor is Will Panzo. Nick Lowe is editor. Joe Quesada, editor-in-chief. Dan Buckley is publisher. And Captain Britain is squaring off against... some mandroids. I always love when mandroids show up, Trey. You know,
they look cool.
They are very much, you know, the bargain basement, everybody can get these at the surplus sale kind of armor. Because, you know, everybody has, like, I'm pretty sure if you look at my garage right now, I've probably got mandroid armor.
Mandroid armor is for when a guardsman suit is just not in the budget.
Yeah. That's not true, by the way. I don't have mandroid armor in my garage. I don't have a garage. But... we now have found out that Captain Britain's powers are now linked to confidence. His confidence in himself. I think where previously it was linked to, like, how close to Britain he was.
Right, it was geographic.
Which, you know, Beast. Remember our discussion about Beast last issue? Talking about, like, how Beast is like, you know, this is the reason you weren't in the Avengers before now. Like, no, the reason he wasn't in the Avengers before now is because his powers are geography-based. The further away
he had a very limited radius of, like, full strength superpowers.
Exactly. He'd be useless in a space mission. Unless it's, like, right. You know, Space Britain, which is also from Doctor Who.
Well, now, here's the thing. If he's flying in a spaceship that is flying under the British flag, is it considered UK territory? And therefore a part of the UK politically? And does that count?
You know, that gets into an era of of imperialism I'm not ready to talk about, Trey.
Right. Yeah. So, not to encourage colonialism, but if he lands on an alien planet and immediately plants a flag, does that count?
We're going to move on from here.
Needless to say, the confidence thing is a better version of this.
Better version of that.
Because it doesn't raise these kinds of questions.
Yeah. Yeah. So Pete Wisdom is like, hey, we've got some new members incoming. And of course, we're talking about Blade. Blade apparently is English, which I forgot. And apparently, like, MI-13 forgot, too. And Blade's like, yeah, right. I was made here. I was raised here. It's fine. We then go to...
he was born in London.
Yep. We then transition to a... Sons of the Serpent recruitment meeting somewhere in Dulwich, which is being broken up by Spitfire and Union Jack. Hey, Trey, it's our boy.
I told you he'd show up for at least a cameo.
Yeah, there we go. And he's like, I hope you're not too offended that I've turned down the offer to join this team. I'm going to stick with the stuff I'm doing currently. And
yeah, he's MI5, right?
Yeah, MI5. And she's like, it's cool. We got a good team. I've got everything under control on my end. And he's like, are you sure? Maybe we should work together. And he's like, nah, it'll be fine. We then go to Essex, where Faiza is taking Dane Whitman to meet her family, because they've been briefed somewhat on the whole, you know, our daughter is a superhero now situation, but not fully on our daughter is a superhero situation. And God, this stuff with the family is so much fun, Trey. It's like,
it really is. Mainly because of Dane. Like, yes. He's great.
Yeah. And like, I love the father's like, you know, Dane's like, don't worry, I'm going to explain all this to your mother, it'll be fine. And you think he's doing great, because he comes in with like his really bad Urdu, and he's like, you know, I know my Urdu isn't what would be considered modern, but here's me showing respect to you and your family. And his father's like, oh, no, I know exactly where you learned Urdu. You learned it in the freaking Crusades. And Dane's like, oh, whoa, 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 whoa. For one thing, in Dane's defense, I'm pretty sure he was stoned during the Crusades. Like, most.
That sounds right.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he was stoned. So,
yeah, he's had a rough go of it.
Yeah. Anyway, we'll come back to them. We then go back to Blade being shown around the facility. Spitfire is feeling a bit uneasy. Meanwhile, back at Faze's parents' place, Dane's like, I've come to a decision. And Faze's mom's like, oh my god, you're getting married. And we're like, whoa, 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 whoa. No. I mean, not that I wouldn't be, she's a lovely girl, but no, I mean, it's beautiful. Beautiful. And like, her mom.
I love that the mom then whispers, it's always interesting what happens when I say that to a boy, as though she does this to every guy that comes in.
The milkman. Really fun stuff. And like, he's basically, Dane just lays it all out on the table for him. Listen, you know your daughter's a superhero, but you need to know what she's going to be dealing with. She's going to be dealing with monsters, because like, all the evil magic got let out in the past paperback. Pick it up, it's at your local library. And basically, we're going to be cleaning it up. As you so eloquently put it, last episode, Trey, we're Ghosts of Scooby-Doo, 13 Ghosts of Scooby-Dooing this. And they're still like, well, why our daughter? Why her? And like, I get that she's a superhero, but why pick her for this? And like, we didn't pick her. And he has her take Excalibur out of her bag. And he's like, that did. And it's a really great moment where she hands her dad Excalibur and he just feels it. Like, he feels this is Britain. This is Britain accepting us. Like,
it's sort of like the inverse of when everybody felt Captain Britain die.
Yeah. Yeah. Real, real good stuff. But then back at MI-13, they get a message from Captain Midlands being like, hey, shit's going down in Birmingham. I need you guys here now, pronto. And so they sound the trouble alert, and Faiza and Dane hop a winged horse and make their way there. And Captain Britain flies ahead, and Blade hops in an air transport, where Spitfire runs up a church steeple. Really good scene. Just runs up church steeple and like jumps into the side of the air transport. And there's a scene there where she's introducing herself to everybody, and she's introducing herself to Blade. And he's like, Eric Brooks, meet Lady. And Peatland was like, Eric Brooks, which apparently is Blade's real name. I always forget that. Meet Jacqueline Fallsworth Crichton. It's like, ah, Lady Jacqueline, that's not what you are to me. And she's like, oh, what am I to you, Mr. Blade? And she thinks he's going to do the, you know, like, oh, you've been, like, my hero since, like, you know, as a little kid. Because, you know, that's what she gets all the time, right? Because, you know, she's a living legend in World War II, an invader, right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
She's got a little bit of, like, the post-crisis JSA thing going.
Exactly. Yeah, she's got a little bit of that Captain America riz on her. But no, he's like, another dead vampire and stakes her through the heart. Oh, man.
How's that for a final issue, like final page of the issue?
That is. How did they not see that coming?
Right.
How?
Well, because they don't know she's a vampire.
Pete Wisdom does.
Right. Yeah. But Pete's not really thinking straight right now.
He thinks they have it on the DL. Like, he thinks that, like, it's a state secret that nobody knows about.
Right.
But, like, fucking know that Blade's gonna fucking know that shit? How do you know he doesn't have, like, vampire senses? Like, my vampire senses are tingling, motherfuckers.
Yep. Which he, I mean, I don't know about in the comics right now, but in the movies, he kinda does.
Yeah. Like, how did you think you were gonna pull this off?
Right.
Like I said, we're not stopping here. We're moving on to our next issue. That is number 6. And that is Leonard Kirk back on pencils. Jesse Dilberdang? As our inker.
Dilberdang
is our inker. Brian Reber is our colorist. And I think Daniel Ketchum is our assistant editor. Don't ask him about his son Ash. It's a sore subject. And that's a Pokemon reference there for any of you people out there who aren't aware. But by the way, we neglected to formally congratulate Ash on becoming the Pokemon Master of them all on the show. That was an oversight on our part, and we apologize. Of course, Nicola's editor, Joe says they're in chief, and Dan Buckley is our publisher. In Birmingham, a apartment block has been surrounded with this weird red flame, and the people from the apartment block are outside being like, come in, we can give you your heart's desire. It is very much, it reminded me a lot of the opening scenes in, like, Dawn of the Dead.
Mm-hmm.
That's the mall one, right?
It is.
Yeah. Like, it reminds me very much of the apartment block scene in Dawn of the Dead, which, yeah, I like that vibe.
Yep.
And she's like, come inside, we can give you everything you want. And Captain Britain's like, okay, sure, give me the tour. Meanwhile, aboard the plane, like, all these MI-13 agents are holding Blade back, and like, what the hell are you doing? And she, like Spitfire is screaming, Pete Wisdom pulls the stake out of her. Thaisa, on horseback, flying alongside the plane, does a, you know, quick repair to her. Really good. And she's like, oh, what? She's magical? Why did nobody tell me? Like, that was just really great. And she starts to heal, and Blade's like, if you're with her, you aren't with me. And dives out of the plane into the hellfire-surrounded apartment block. Everybody else lands. She starts to... Oh, she is getting repaired. Oh, part of her hand kind of starts to disintegrate. She starts to dust. She starts to turn to dust before...
Right, she's going full, like, Buffy vampire.
Yeah. Before Faiza kind of helps heals her and puts it back together, before they pull the stake out, she starts to dust, like, her arm to her skeletal. But it's weird, because which arm it is in the artwork kind of changes.
I'm wondering if in doing individual panels, if things ended up getting flipped or mirrored or something.
Gotta be. Anyway, she's like, I'm going to rush in and see what's going on. I'm going to check on Blade. Like, Blade's in there somewhere, I'll go and get him. Meanwhile, Captain Britain's been giving a tour, and basically he's finding out that all the people in these apartment buildings, each different apartment is being given a different heart's desire. You know, some people want wealth, some people want success, some people want happiness, and it's stuff like, you know, somebody's rich, somebody's a soccer star, somebody has their family back, and they're like, we can give you what you want too. And he's like, no, I don't want anything. You don't have anything I want. And then while he's doing that, we have Black Knight, Faiza, and Pete Wisdom busting in the front door. Like, all right, let's go. Smash. And they're just, you know, wading through these people. Meanwhile, Blade and Spitfire, they do some flirty fight thing. It's kind of weird, but like, yeah, that's all they're doing this whole, like, three issues. They're flirty fighting. And it's really weird, because, like, he just staked you. Why are you flirting with him? But at the same time, he's like, your accent reminds me of a 60s horror film. It's kind of hot.
Right.
And, like...
Right, okay. Blade is like, you are the epitome of pure evil, and I'm into it.
Yeah, I kind of have a thing for Hammer horror chicks, which, you know, valid.
I mean, we've read Tomb of Dracula.
Yes, we have. Anyway, again, Black Knight, Faiza, and Pete Wisdom are kind of like, you know, wading through these people, trying very hard not to hurt them, just pushing them aside with the swords, not like, you know, slashing the swords, even though Black Knight's saying, hey, I really kind of want to slash these people with the swords. Like, the Ebony Blade, it's talking to me. It wants blood. And I'm not getting that right now, but I want it. Meanwhile, Captain Britain comes to the person who is behind all this, and it's Plakta. Yeah. Who apparently is a Lord of Hell, which, okay, sure, one of many.
And this is first appearance, so he's not somebody from, like, a Silver or Bronze Age comic or anything. Okay. This is a first appearance.
Okay, cool. He apparently is the one who makes the Nameless Ones, the Mindless Ones, excuse me. And yes. Basically what he does is he will set up a Mindless Ones factory on a planet and just churn them out.
Yep.
And
he's from the Dark Dimension.
Yep.
Because the Mindless Ones are from the Dark Dimension.
Exactly. Anyway, Black Knight, Pete Wisdom, and Faiza find Captain Midland's in the basement, and he's like, they tried to tempt me, but I didn't give in. I knew what they were going to offer me, but I knew I couldn't take it. And he's like, I'll lead you to where they are. And apparently, he went in trying to bust up a drug den on this council estate. And he found out that, you know, in addition to heroin, they're also getting high off this Lord of Hell's powers. And then, of course, Plakta shows Captain Britain what he has to tempt him with. And for anybody who read 90s Excalibur, we already knew what he was going to tempt him with. And of course, it's Megan.
Yep, yep.
This temptation would also work on Nightcrawler.
Yes, yes. But he would feel more guilty about it.
Exactly. His dang plastic Catholic guilt. So
he and Matt Murdock should have like a support group for that.
Oh, man. You know, it always bugged me when they try to make Nightcrawler a priest.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, I'm sorry. I'm pretty sure...
Didn't the animated series and the movie kind of do that?
Yeah. Both the animated series and the movie kind of forgot the fact where, like, Kurt's chasing ladies here,
right.
There, and everywhere.
He's a swashbuckling ladies man.
Yeah. Which, one of the things I like about X-Men Evolution, they did not forget that he was a swashbuckling ladies man.
No, they leaned into that.
Yeah, like, oh, hello, Fräulein. My name is Kurt. Would you like to go on a date tonight? I'm like, oh, you as well, Fräulein. Date tomorrow night.
Totally off topic, but if you haven't read it, the Nightcrawler miniseries Uncanny Spider-Man, where he gets a spare Spider-Man costume from Peter Parker and operates as a spider person with a tail.
Why?
Because it's good.
Why, though?
Because of Krakoa stuff.
Oh, so I'll get there eventually when I, you know, finish my Claremont read through.
Right, right.
And then
Kurt's working through some things.
Yeah.
But Nightcrawler playing at being Spider-Man is fun.
I mean,
and also Peter Parker is like, how'd you get the suit to like do that with your tail? Because it's not like there's a hole in the suit for the tail to come out of.
He put one there, just, like, dipped his tail in ink. I have seen pictures from it, and it looks cool. And yeah. Is that the one where they revealed the Mystique stuff?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Okay.
That sounds right. I don't think I read the entirety of the miniseries, but it starts strong.
Okay, cool. Again, like I said, at some point I'll get there. I just have to finish...
Once you get through all of the Claremont stuff and the Jim Lee stuff and... The Morrison stuff, and the Whedon stuff, and the Hickman stuff, and...
Listeners, for those of you who are on the internet, and apparently some of you are if you're listening to this podcast, I signed up for a website called Legion of Comic Geeks. It's basically Letterboxd for comic reading, which, awesome, because I love tracking stuff. The only thing that make it better is they gave me little badges for, like, doing certain runs or something like that. They don't currently, but if you
achievements.
Know, yeah, unlock achievements. That's what I want. Make me feel like my wasting time is earned. But basically, I created a reading list for myself with the Claremont run as the basis for it. And I'm like, well, if I'm reading the Claremont run, I should really read John Byrne's Fantastic Four as well. It's been a few years since I read it, so I'll add that into that there as well. And if I'm reading Byrne's Fantastic Four, I might as well read Byrne's Alpha Flight. And if I'm going to read Byrne's Alpha Flight... And I'm reading Fantastic Four, you know, I should really add, you know, Roger Stern's Spider-Man and Grunewald's
right.
Captain America and
right.
Burns' She-Hulk and...
So, readers, you can see how this snowballs, right? Or yeah. Listeners, rather. You can see how this snowballs.
Yeah. Currently, my reading list has 1,054 comics in it. And
that's not counting stuff that you're reading for the show.
No, it doesn't. It does not count stuff I'm reading for the show. However, do not be surprised if I slip some reading list reading into the show.
I was about to say, so what you're saying is the next time we have grab bags, it's going to be a bunch of Bronze Age team-ups and two-in-ones.
Yes, that is exactly the case. Like, we will talk about the Spider-Man meets the Not Ready for Primetime Players issue on this show, because, man, it's goofy.
Yep.
I don't know if it's as goofy as a David Letterman Avengers issue.
That one is weird.
It is so goofy. Anyway, issue 7. Follow me on League of Comic Geeks. I'm at Mr. Hickson. There we go. Okay. Captain Britain and MI-13 number 7. Writer, of course, is Paul Cornell. Our penciler is Leonard Kirk again. We've got Michael Baer, Jay Leston, and Craig Ying as inkers. Brian Reber with John Rauch as our colorist. Joe Caramanga is our letterer. Daniel Ketchum is our assistant editor. Nick Lowe is editor. Joe Quesada is our chief. And Dan Buckley is our publisher. This is part 2, because remember, previous ones were prologue. There we go. Prologue, that's the word. Prologue.
And part 1.
Part 1. And now we're at part 2. And Kenneth Brennan's like, oh, so is this like a portal? Or are you just like showing me an image? And he's like, well, it's just an image. But he's like, so there's magic moving back and forth between these things, right? Yes. Like, okay. Well, I get it. You're trying to tempt me with her, or I can just go get her. And he flies through the door and starts beating up on these Eldritch horrors, holding his wife captive. And whatever his name is, Lord of Hell Dude, is like, awesome. Octo. Slam the door. It's like, we trapped him.
And the little lady that's sort of possessed by him just like turns the key and locks the door.
Yep. We got him, boys. And he's like, okay, we're feeding on superhero energy now. And he just starts like churning out mindless ones. And meanwhile, the field is expanding and they realize that if they don't get this contained, in 3 days it'll cover all of Britain, and in a week the world. Which, I want to see the what if where it's just like Skrulls are like, we've conquered the planet! Mindless the ones!
Mindless ones. Skrulls versus mindless ones. Oh,
like,
I love
hell?
It.
The hell? And they can't, you know, shut down the factories because they can't get into Britain.
Right. So. Right. No, well, you know how that ends, right?
They nuke the planet from orbit?
No. Galactus just shows up and eats it.
Oh.
Like Galactus shows up and is like, well, I can just solve this problem for everybody.
I'm sure that won't cause any residual trauma for the Skrulls at all. Anyway, I love the fact that Secret Invasion is all Wolverine's fault, basically.
Yes.
Because he wasn't able to prevent Galactus from eating the Skrull homeworld. Because he didn't have his antimantium claws. He only had bone claws. And the bone claws were not enough to destroy Galactus' ship. Which just shows you...
that bone claws are dumb?
Bone claws are dumb, Trey!
Yep.
We're gonna get that on a t-shirt. anyway. So, yeah. Things are expanding, and there is now a timeline for this. Because, you know, it isn't just going to be Birmingham. It's going to be the world. And inside this little pocket dimension, Brian has found Megan, and they have a really nice reunion. And he's all like, hey, we're orbiting Earth, so let's just, you know, free fall into Earth. Let's just go for it. And so he's like, I've done it before. I'll help you through it. Let's go. Meanwhile, Blade and Spitfire have been confronted with by mindless ones. So they're like, okay, fine, let's put our differences aside for a little bit so we can beat up on these things. We then go back to, let's see, hold on. Dane's talking about the fact that, hey, I'm trying really hard not to give in to the Ebony Blade right now. More about that later. Plocto, is it Plocto?
Plocto.
Okay, cool.
Plocto 1-0.
Okay. He has gotten a hold of Pete Wisdom, and he shows him his heart's desire, which is the moon from that old Trip to the Moon film, which I just, it's lovely. Lovely yep. little reference there. But he's having dinner on the moon with Maureen and Kitty Pryde. And they're like, you know, we're both alive and well, and nothing bad has happened to us. One of us is definitely not stuck in a giant bullet traveling through the cosmos. And, oh, look!
Which at this point was very much a status quo thing.
Yeah. Yep, that was the thing. Oh, and look, there's John the Skrull over there, perfectly fine. By the way, Trey, why is Lockhead's head mounted?
Did Pete Wisdom just not like Lockheed?
He must not have. Like,
I don't remember from that relationship, but
yeah,
maybe they didn't get along.
Yeah, okay. That, well, fuck you, Pete Wisdom. Everyone loves Lockheed. Screw this guy. Like, everyone loves Lockheed. Everyone. But of course, Dane has to slap the shit out of Pete Wisdom, which, again, I'm fully for now. I wake him up and be like, hey, you are dreaming. We are under siege right now. And it's Captain Midland's, Faiza, and Pete Wisdom, and Black Knight just wailing on some mindless ones, which is, again, valid. It, meanwhile, at Braddock Manor, we have Megan and Brian hanging out at the Braddock Arms, which apparently is a pub at the end of the driveway of Braddock Manor, which, of course, Brian built a pub at the end of his driveway. Of course.
Bit of a male fantasy, really.
Yeah, exactly. A pub with my name on it. There we go. And he's talking about, you know, how happy he is with the, to be back with Megan. And it's like, it's so good. And like, what? Nothing can mess this up. And that's when his brother shows up. If you don't know, listeners, this is the older Braddock brother. Right? Yeah. James Braddock.
Yeah.
James Braddock.
Yeah.
Who is cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. And also a heavy metal fan. So he and Brian smash up the place. Meanwhile, speaking of bombshells, Blade lays one on Spitfire, telling her, hey, just so you know, I brought back all the vampires. And this is not good news for Spitfire, who, you know, has some history there, including
yep.
her own
yep.
son being a vampire. Which I believe is the Roger Stern Captain America run.
Yeah, yeah. Kenneth Crichton is
Kenneth
her son.
Yeah, Kenneth Crichton. Okay. I'll get there eventually. That's
yeah,
on my list.
Yeah. Who I think was, he was supposed to be next in line to be Union Jack, being sort of that family, but says that Joey Chapman, who we saw earlier, was really more suited to the role and sort of gave it to him instead.
Exactly. And it's, you know, he ends up becoming Baron Blood instead, and
right.
she has to help put him down, which
right,
she
right.
considers a mercy, even though it's her son.
Right.
Anyway, there's a bunch of fighty fight between James and Brian and the pub, and James kills Brian. James kills Brian Braddock. Meanwhile, Black Knight is getting really, really, really into the whole slashing things with a sword thing, and so he almost kills Faiza until Pete Wisdom yells out, Whitman, that's not the Ebony Blade. And that's where the issue ends.
Dun, dun, dun.
If you hadn't said it,
surprised
I would have.
Surprised Squirrel Jif.
Yeah. Wow. Not the Ebony Blade.
Yep. This series is really good at the final page reveals.
Yes. Really, really good at it. God, Trey's so good. It's so much fun. All of it.
Yep.
So much fun.
Yep.
Like, where to even start? I mean, we've talked about some of it here.
Yeah, so back, starting with issue 5, it's fitting that they call it the prologue, because really this is mostly establishing the status quo for this team.
Mm-hmm.
What their mandate is, what they're up to, who our key players are.
Yes.
Which is nice. It's nice that we get just a few moments of all of them in this sort of grounded, before the action begins moment. To really get a feel for them.
Yes. I love the fact that Pete Wisdom knew Jacqueline was a vampire and just didn't tell anybody. Like, Alistair Stewart is like, you knew? You
right.
knew? And again, like I said, the stuff with Faze's parents is amazingly fun.
Yes. that feels sort of straight out of, like, British comedy, like British sitcom kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And, again, bringing in Megan, and be like, hey, here's what you could have.
This is the one thing we know you can't resist.
Exactly. Is really good. Captain Midlands is fun.
Yeah, so he's a character that I think first appeared in the Wisdom miniseries, the Max series that Paul Cornell did. And for those of you who maybe haven't read that series, Captain Midlands is the British counterpart to Captain America. So he is also a product of a 1940s super soldier program, in this case one run by the UK. He has increased strength, stamina, and agility. Unlike Steve Rogers, he never got frozen in ice, and so he aged normally. And so he has, like, the body of, like, an 80-year-old retiree, but he still has all the superhuman powers.
Exactly.
The other thing right now that's worth, just off of the first half of this arc, that's worth knowing, so he does have his own shield. It is not vibranium or adamantium or anything. Instead, it's coated with something called nanominium, which is a British development, which has anti-magical properties.
Interesting.
So he has an anti-magic shield because the UK.
It makes sense.
And that shield was created by the MI-13 quartermaster. Oh.
Oh, really?
Who is the guy we see in the first issue of the arc running the tests on Captain Britain.
Okay, that makes sense. Again, the fight flirting between Spitfire and Blade is weird but fun at the same time.
It makes sense, I think. I like it. One, I like any time that a comic actually tries to give Blade a personality beyond just being gruff vampire killer.
Mm-hmm.
It's the sort of thing that I don't like as much about the trilogy of Blade movies, is that with each successive movie, he has less personality.
Yeah. As in, Wesley Snipes could be less bothered to show up and do his job and not just smoke weed all day.
Right. I mean, the sort of anecdote from, I guess it was Patton Oswalt, about how, like, he wouldn't even take his sunglasses off, that kind of thing.
Yep.
So, yeah, so I like that. I also just, Jacqueline Fallsworth as this kind of not quite femme fatale character, but somewhere in the ballpark of that, is something fun to play with.
She very much is a Hammer horror girl, really.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Like,
it is insane. She's lifted almost whole cloth from a Hammer horror film, which...
Right. And that she is this sort of ageless blonde who has been around since the 40s kind of adds to that.
Yes. It's...
Because when you say Hammer horror girl, specifically like 70s Hammer horror.
Yes. Yes. Which, you know, like, people like Roy Thomas were watching because we've read those issues of Tomb of Dracula and things like that, which are very much, hey, Marvel's going to do Hammer now.
Yep. I really like the design of Plucto.
Yes.
I like that he's this non-corporeal kind of thing. It's a little bit Steve Ditko, but it's like Steve Ditko by way of 60s Star Trek.
He feels like something that's been in the universe for a while. Like,
yeah, and he feels cosmic.
I was shocked to find out that he was a new creation.
Yeah. Because that's the thing, is I read this, and especially with his connection to the Mindless Ones, I'm immediately going to Marvel Wiki. It's like, okay, like, when in the 1970s did this guy show up?
Exactly. But no.
And the answer was no.
Yeah. It's... There you go. Really.
I also just really like it when the Mindless Ones show up and stuff. I know there's not much to them, but it's just such a really creepy, cool design for a monster.
Yes.
Like, they look like something from 70s, 80s Doctor Who.
Yes. They are a classic Ditko design. And
yes, they are.
They work really well alongside Pulaski.
Plucto?
Pulaski. They work really well alongside the season two Doctor.
Plinko.
Oh, there you go. That works way better than the season 2 Star Trek Next Generation Doctor. Good job, Trey.
Yes. But the mindless ones, like, especially the way they're rendered here, especially in this British setting, like I say, it's like that they evoke that kind of, I don't know, 70s, 80s Who. They would not be out of place in a Tom Baker episode, is all I'm saying.
And this setting is really fun. Like, I know I invoked, you know, Dawn of the Dead earlier, but you could also invoke, I think, a horror film that comes out later after this, Attack the Block.
Sure.
Which is very much alien threat on a council estate.
And these aren't kids, but the glowing eyes and the what I read as a very monotone voice, Village of the Damned.
Oh, yeah. All of it.
Yeah.
Just really fun stuff.
The subplot running with Dane Whitman gradually having to struggle more and more against the sword is building nicely. It's something that was hinted at a little bit in the first story arc, and they're really elaborating on it now.
It's all good stuff, Trey. It's all really, really good stuff. Should we move on to our second half?
Probably. Probably a good idea. We left on this cliffhanger. That's not the Ebony Blade.
Yeah, let's go ahead and take a quick break, and, you know, everybody go in and grab some more coffee.
Yeah, no, this is British. Make some tea.
No, but Trey, you could never have enough coffee. I should have some more coffee.
Oh, my. Mm. While I investigate just how much caffeine is too much caffeine, let's take a break, and we'll be right back.
Hey, kids, comics.
It was the dawn of a new age of comic book podcasting. Hey Kids Comics was a dream given form, a place where two generations of comic book fans could work out their differences peaceably. It was a humorous place where nothing was sacrosanct, and it was our last, best hope for joy. But all things end. But from endings can come new beginnings. This is the return of a comic book podcast. The year is 2023. The name of the show is Hey Kids Comics. Michael and Andrew are back with an all-new look at old comics and all old looks at new comics. You can go home again. Hey Kids Comics, monthly from Two True Freaks and wherever you get your comics-related podcasts.
Hey Kids Comics!
In an unknown domain of space.
Any sign of life? No.
They unleashed a power that has sought vengeance for 1,000 years. The lord of an unholy empire and the captain of an unsuspecting crew begin a battle that will turn the heavens into hell. Casper Van Dien, Erica Eleniak, Coolio, Alexandra Camp, and Tiny Lister. Dracula 3000.
Welcome back to Tomb of Ideas. Next, we are looking at roughly the second half of the Hell Comes to Birmingham story arc. So this is issues 8 and 9. And starting with Captain Britain MI-13 number 8, our creative team is once again written by Paul Cornell, penciled by Leonard Kirk. Our team of inkers are Michael Blair, Jay Leiston, and Craig Jung. The colorist is Brian Reber. The letterer is VC's Joe Caramanga. The editor is Nick Lowe, assistant editor Daniel Ketchum, editor-in-chief Joe Quesada, publisher Dan Buckley. And just for what it's worth, the cover is Brian Hitch and Brian Reber. We open with Blade slicing through Plokto with a paper sword.
It's really fun.
It's great. Turns out that Blade just happens to have a word sword, a papier-mâché sword made from the pages of magic books, which is incredibly useful against demons.
Yes. Isn't it just?
Jacqueline is basically crumpled in pieces on the ground from the fall that she took in the previous issue. She fell down the elevator shaft and broke basically every bone in her body.
Yep.
And then Blade is like, what are you talking about? We just established you're a vampire. Pull yourself together, literally. And then she does, including healing her hand that had started to disintegrate back at the beginning of the story arc.
Yeah, I'm a bit surprised she didn't need, like, you know, blood to do this, but...
Right, okay. Right. So all I can figure is she drank all that Skrull blood and doesn't really use her vampire powers. So I wonder if the fact that she hadn't been making use of the vampire abilities meant that that residual energy was just stored, waiting to be used.
There's a chance, yeah.
And so Blade and Fire are more or less on the same side at this point, and so they start making their way up. Meanwhile, outside the building, Alistair Stewart and his sort of task force out there are trying to contain the Mindless Ones, which are now escaping out into the street, and he activates a pentagram tesseract, an intrusion of magical fields into another dimension, and he's going to use this thing to try and capture one of the Mindless Ones. Back inside, Dane Whitman regains consciousness and is like, oh yeah, I did know that this isn't the Ebony Blade. It's in Wakanda. Which is true. That was previously established in other comics that T'Challa had the Ebony Blade. And Wisdom notes, though, that whatever this sword is, it's incredibly powerful and is magical and is a good enough copy that it can even fool Camelot. And so Dane holds on to it, even though he previously was about to kill them all using it. And Captain Midland says we need to hurry and find the source of the evil. Alistair Stewart activates the magical trap thing that he's set, but before we can find out whether it worked or not, we cut to the Dream Corridor, where Captain Britain is still trapped, and evidently he did not die when the illusion of his brother stabbed him. And the illusion of his brother removes its mask and reveals that he is actually Captain Britain's unconscious. And so this is sort of a side effect of his dying and being reforged by Merlin, that his unconscious is especially strong and has physically manifested in the dream to try and shake him out of the illusions. His unconscious literally rips the images off of the panel, revealing the blank white space behind it. It's really cool. And suddenly they are in the sort of empty void of the Dream Corridor. Captain Britain says he doesn't need his unconscious help anymore, and he walks away as Megan cries that, no, she's real, don't leave her behind.
Oh, it's heartbreaking, Trey. It is.
Yep.
Because, like, Megan's whole thing is, like, she's Faye, and she's shaped by others' perceptions of her.
Mm-hmm.
Just like, you know, Asgardians and, like, other creatures like that. So, with Brian believing she isn't real, she just starts to fade. And she's like, no, I'm real. And,
It hurts.
It hurts so much. And we knew this about Megan, because if you don't remember, like, again, that Excalibur run, there's a great scene where she and Nightcrawler are training. And she starts to get, she starts shifting based off of Nightcrawler's crush on her.
Yep.
To the point where she starts turning blue and getting pointy ears and a tail.
Well, she already has the pointy ears.
Yeah, okay, fine.
but yes, but the tail.
Yeah. It's so good. Anyway.
Yep. We don't see the consequences of that yet. We cut back to Plotto and his sort of lead minion, who again is this older retired woman who lives in the building. Plotto notices that the power is fluctuating wildly in his Dream Corridor and says they need to hurry up and complete their plan, that they need to spring the trap. Outside the building, Stewart has caught a Mindless One, but that doesn't really do them any immediate good because the rest of the army of Mindless Ones are still advancing. Brian is flying through the Dream Corridor, accompanied by his unconscious. And he sees what looks like a portal to the apartment building where he started, but then realizes that that must be a trap because it's his heart's desire right now is to get back to his teammates, and therefore any portal back to that building must be the Dream Corridor manifesting that desire.
It's
and
too
so
easy.
He turns his right. He turns his back on it and muses about how to get out. Back outside the building, Stewart goes inside the magical trap with the Mindless One, because he is going to use an ability we've not seen yet, but that he does have. Because of an unfortunate encounter with Morgan Le Fay, he is cursed to have a mutable, malleable form, which allows him to do all kinds of weird magic stuff. And so he's going to try and experiment with the Mindless One's connections to other dimensions.
Yeah. He tears the Mindless One's hole open and crawls in.
Yep. He literally uses it as a portal. It's awesome.
So, like, it reminds me, you know, the whole fact that, like, Cyclops' optical blasts are just gateways to another dimension.
Right.
And he's just opening it to, like, this pure force dimension. And he just, you know, the Ruby Quartz visor modulates how much is getting through.
Yep.
Like, it's basically the same principle, but the darkness.
Right. But it's as though, but at the same time, I don't want to see Alistair Stewart or anyone else crawl into Cyclops' eye sockets.
I do.
Seems upsetting for everyone involved.
But wait, hold on. If that's true, how does it generate heat?
We should ask Gail Simone. She's an expert on this subject.
We should ask Gail Simone, yeah. Anyway.
So, back inside the building, Captain Midlands is leading them down the hallway when Faiza says that Excalibur is sensing magic behind all of the doors except one, and that one must be Plotta's headquarters. So, Wisdom rushes in, saying that if there's a trap, then he's going to be the one to spring it, basically. He opens the door and throws his hot knife energy blasts at what is revealed to be Blade and Spitfire. Spitfire says, stop attacking Blade, he's on our side now. Wisdom says, I did miss. Blade then gives us a little bit of that exposition, so this is where we find out that Plotto is a Duke of Hell from the Dark Dimension. We get a nice little Dormammu cameo there, and that he basically sets up shop generating Mindless Ones, basically ruining whatever planet or space he's set up that factory. It's sort of a way of communicating to other evil forces, this is our territory, stay out.
It also ties up their forces where, like, they can't challenge them because they're so busy fighting Mindless Ones.
Right, exactly. And with all of the evil magic loose on Earth, this is Plotto sort of trying to stake a claim. And so Wisdom really wants to kick Blade off the team and send him back to America. Spitfire doesn't want that to happen. She says, as the injured party, that she votes that he stay. And suddenly Captain Midlands breaks up the argument by rushing through a door. The others follow, and suddenly they are in 1942 England.
Yep.
And Captain Midlands introduces them all to his wife, who died in the early 60s, and it turns out that this has all been a trap, and that Captain Midlands was secretly working for Plotto this whole time.
Ooh.
Plot twist.
Well, they use the same bait they use for Captain Britain. Like,
right. Except it worked.
It totally worked. I mean, it worked for Captain Britain too, let's be honest here.
Well, briefly. But Captain Britain had a superpowered unconscious forged by Merlin.
Okay, fine, yes.
Wisdom is furious at Captain Midland's betrayal. This is treason. Wisdom immediately destroys the illusion of Captain Midland's wife.
She breaks like porcelain. It's, oh, so good.
Yep. Which causes Midlands to just utterly crack because Toh's not going to replace her. That they're all trapped exactly as this reality is. It is a locked off infinite dimension. Because they came in willingly, they can't get out. Wisdom says, screw that. Dane, give me the ebony blade or whatever it is. And he starts slicing holes in dimensions, trying to get back to reality. Meanwhile, Alistair Stewart is kind of doing the same thing. He has gone through the weird portal mouth of the Mindless One and has popped out in the void of the Dream Corridor where Brian Braddock is floating. And so now they're together, and Brian uses Alistair Stewart's connection to reality to find a reference point. He basically triangulates to find a path back to Earth.
It's really fun, too. Yep. Alistair, you're not my heart's desire.
Ben.
I have never once wished for you to be in the same room as me. That means you're real.
Oh, boy.
And so now we have Brian on one in one plot thread and the rest of the team in the other, both working their way back toward reality. And along the way, Wisdom slices through a bunch of the fantasies that we already saw, the football game and the family and the moon and all of that. Meanwhile, Megan pops through a portal into the dream corridor, calling out to Brian that she finally caught up to him, only to see him leaving again. And her last words are, "I'm real."
Ugh.
Really hurts.
Really hurts! And, like, they draw her so beautifully here. It's just...
Yeah. Toto senses that his power is diminishing because all of his power sources, all of the superhumans he's captured, are escaping. His minion, the elderly lady, starts to remember who she really is and what her life really is, and sort of breaks down because she remembers all of the people that she loved are dead. And Pete, in this great splash page, Pete Wisdom points accusingly with a glowing hand and says, "Step away from the pensioner."
Oh, good stuff.
Plotto gloats because he is a demonic cosmic being, and basically none of them are powerful enough to defeat him, but they attack anyway. Most of them are fighting the mindless ones. Wisdom says, "Try and get to Plotto." Plotta. Mm-hmm. Is it Plotta? Plotta.
Plotta.
I've been saying Plotto this whole time, but it's Plotta. And just then, Brian shows up to save the day, and with his supreme confidence in his own abilities, he is able to power through the mindless ones and shove Plotta through the doorway into the dream dimension. And so Plotta, whose power source is the energy in the dream corridor, is now trapped in the dream corridor himself. And so his power is consuming itself, which seems dangerous and unstable. And so Alistair Stewart, back outside, draws him through the mindless one that was in the trap. And so now they have a Duke of Hell trapped inside this pentagram machine.
Yes.
And then, just to be safe, Alistair Stewart turns the whole thing off. Captain Midlands is taken away in shackles, begging for them not to do this publicly. Wisdom then turns his attention to Blade, and once again, Spitfire sort of calls for him to be allowed to stay on the team. Wisdom sort of cheekily says, "I love it when you call me sir," and says Blade stays, but he's on probation. And Alistair Stewart talks to Brian a little bit about his curse from Morgan Le Fay, and we're left with Blade and Jacqueline alone, where she embraces him and kisses him, and then says she doesn't quite know why she did that.
Oh,
meanwhile, in what seems to be some realm of hell, Megan is alone and surrounded by demons.
Yeah.
Seems not great.
No.
Captain Midlands is in a high-security prison awaiting trial. Wisdom walks in. They agree that neither of them can bear the thought of him standing trial, and so Wisdom leaves him a gun as an alternative and walks away. The epilogue. In a mysterious castle somewhere, a woman is taken down a dark corridor, talking about how excited she is to be turned into a vampire.
Yeah, she is.
Suddenly a creature reaches out from the shadows, bites her neck, drains her completely of blood, killing her. And then, in the final splash, on the moon, Dracula wipes the blood from his lips and gazes out in the distance toward Earth. Tell our forces in London to prepare phase one of the assault and get me Dr. Doom.
Oh, so good, Trey.
Next, Vampire State.
Oh, like, in my head, I've rewritten that song from that one episode of Futurama. Uh-huh. It's not Whalers on the Moon. It's Vampires on the Moon. Vampires on the Moon.
It's great. I love that Dracula has a castle on the moon. It's perfect.
Of course he does. Oh, and it's classic Dracula, too.
Yep.
None of that.
This is not that, like, anime bullshit that he was for a while.
Anime, whatever it is, the game. What's it, the game?
Castlevania?
Anime Castlevania bullshit Dracula. No, this is...
And don't get me wrong, I love the Castlevania games, but that design, that aesthetic, has no business with Marvel's Dracula.
No, this is Gene: Dracula, motherfuckers.
Yep. This is a proper, I watched Hammer Horror, and I drew my version of that Dracula.
Oh, it's so good, Trey. All of this is so good. Yep.
And he is flanked by, like, Nosferatu-style vampire underlings. It's so good.
It's so, so good. It's...
But we should probably talk about how we got there, because the second half of this story, it's got some gut punches in it.
Yeah, like... I just met Captain Midlands, and I am really sad about him.
Yeah.
Like, I get that he's a right-wing pensioner Captain America.
Yeah, but... So here's the thing. In addition to the whole he aged normally because he was never in suspended animation thing, he always kind of reads to me, especially in this story arc, he's a little bit like, he's not so much British Captain America, he's British Ultimate Captain America.
Or British U.S. agent, if you want to go there.
Sure, sure.
It's good stuff.
Yep, yep. But yeah, and just the reveal about the dead wife, and, you know, your heart breaks for him, even as you're mad at him. Like, you know, you go through this roller coaster of emotions just in a couple of pages. It's really good stuff.
It is, and, like, you can't really get mad at Paul Cornell for doing this with the character, considering the fact that he created the character.
Right. It's his character.
Yes.
And it doesn't feel out of character. Like, this feels like a natural decision that this person would make.
Yes. And it's good stuff. It is. And...
Yeah. I also really want to praise Leonard Kirk's art here. The Dream Corridor, especially the void of the Dream Corridor that Brian Braddock is flying through. It's like if Steve Ditko designed a 90s screensaver.
Accurate.
And I love that.
Yes. Oh, man. It's just all of it. So, and the Megan stuff. It breaks your heart, Trey. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because she's right there. Over and over again.
Right there. She's right there. And it's just... Oh. It just makes it... And I'm wondering, like, how long has she been there? What, because, like, with the nature of her being, I'm wondering, like, if it's a thing where, like, he creates the image of her. And because Brian wants it to be her so badly, because
it
of the nature, it becomes her. Like, the nature of her powers, wherever she is in the multiverse, wherever, I don't know, like, it brings that essence there.
Yeah.
And it makes it her. And, oof. Ah. Faiza doesn't get a lot to do in this story.
After a very strong start, sort of getting a whole subplot to herself in the first section, she's a little bit on the back burner here, which sort of makes sense in that she is the least trained. Everyone else is sort of a seasoned hero at this point. And so there is this sense of, especially Dane, kind of staying between her and danger.
Yeah, we don't really talk about it, but Dane makes her his steward in the prologue, and that's the you know, the idea he comes to her parents with, like, I want to make her my steward and help her train,
right?
And it's really fun because you definitely get, there's this little almost romantic subplot, because, you know, everybody's being offered these things their hearts desire, and Dane's like, so what did they offer you? And she looks at him all dreamingly, and he says, nothing. And you're like, yep. Oh, they offered her him, and she's I already have him.
Right. It's also just, it's cool that they have been paired like that, because their blades are also twins.
Yes, although not really, because
because this is a mysterious fake ebony blade.
Made by Dracula, apparently.
Right. Which... We don't know exactly what its nature is, but its bloodlust seems connected to the vampire plot.
Yes. In the last page, Dracula says, they know about the sword.
Right.
but we're ready to move. And it's like, ooh, Dracula intrigue.
I also just want to call attention to, again, another artwork thing that I just love. It's the splash page. It's like page 17 of the last issue. Brian Braddock grabbing the non-corporeal demon and tossing it through a door. I just love the idea that he just physically grabs something that doesn't really have a physical form.
Yes.
Because he is so confident that he can do it that he does it.
Yep. And I'm like, Brian, why didn't it occur to you that Megan might be real? You're so freaking confident in this, Megan, that, like, it becomes Megan. Just, right.
But that's the thing, is in that moment, he is confident that it's not her. He is certain that it's all fake.
And, it might have started out being fake.
Very, very well could have.
I'm really excited about reading the next couple of issues to see if I'm right on that theory, because it makes sense to me. I'm curious to see if it makes sense to Paul Cornell the same way.
Yeah, because I'm trying to remember. I don't really remember how she... Because it wasn't really... I know she sacrificed herself in an X-Men story, but I don't really remember the circumstances.
It's X-Men. Who can remember?
It's X-Men and it's Chris Claremont.
Yeah... It's late Chris Claremont, too.
Which means you'll get there someday.
Listeners, I'm currently at issue 86 of 1056 of my list, just so you all know. It's going to be a journey.
I also just really enjoy all the Alistair Stewart stuff in this issue.
Yes.
Or in these issues, I should say.
He's very much... Alistair Stewart was always kind of... put together as Chris Claremont's love letter to Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's named after Lethbridge Stewart.
The Brigadier.
The Brigadier. And, but he has the personality of the Doctor, and the job of the Doctor, too.
Right.
So, it's fun seeing him in that role here, still being kind of doctory.
But yeah, the Alistair Stewart stuff is a lot of fun.
Just a really fun crossover. Like, the Skrulls thing was fun. The Skrulls were fun. Like, but it's very much a secret invasion tie-in.
Right, that's very much, they're working within the confines of this event that has a very set structure and outcome and all that.
Yeah, they do the best with it that they can. You know, it's not like, I think, like Peter David famously complained once about launching a series in the middle of a crossover event and how much of a headache that is. It's done very well here. And
yes.
But here, where we actually are getting into, like, the stuff that I think once we talk to Paul Cornell, he'll tell us that he wanted to look at in this series.
Mm-hmm.
It's good stuff.
Yeah.
Well, then.
Really, really good, solid middle section of this run.
Yep. Which reminds me, we've come to the middle section of our podcast. We should probably go ahead and take another quick break. And when we come back, Trey... We have our very special guest that I'm very excited about. We have the writer of Captain Britain and MI-13, Paul Cornell, joining
That's
us.
That's right.
So we will just go ahead and go to break right now and come back with that interview. The first half of that interview.
Yes.
Yep. We're splitting over two episodes, guys. If you want the second half, you got to come back next episode.
Right,
We'll also be talking about Dracula on the Moon, so come on. Not that hard.
Come
not
back
that
for
hard
that.
To ask.
Like,
yeah.
Yes.
But also Paul Cornell, part two. But now, part one.
Right. After this.
Do you like spooky movies?
Hair-raising tales.
Insightful criticism.
Judgmental hot takes. Then you're going to love Car Business, the horror podcast on the Cinepunks Podcast Network dedicated to all things weird and spooky.
My name is Leo Don.
And I'm Justin Lohr. And every episode, we're going to tear apart your favorite and not-so-favorite horror movies to get to the bottom of what makes these movies great, or maybe not great.
Whether it's The Beyond, Prince of Darkness, or Inseminoid, we dive in on a double feature every episode, and then we talk about it. Some of our insights are great, and sometimes we just complain.
So if we have to suffer through it, so do you.
Horror Business, available anywhere you find fine podcast products.
Welcome back, Tomb Believers, to Tomb of Ideas, a Marvel Horror Podcast. We are very lucky today to have writer extraordinaire Paul Cornell with us.
Oh, good evening.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on.
Paul, you've worked on so many things, just in case our listeners don't know. Not just, Captain Britain and MI-13, you've also worked on Wolverine,
Action Comics is a particular favorite of mine.
You wrote my all-time favorite episode of Doctor Who, Human Nature.
Bless you.
In addition to 2000 AD, you've written for Elementary, for Robin Hood. You all over the place, not to mention your sort of original creator-owned work. I am a big fan of Saucer Country.
Thank you. you've got the finale. That's lovely. And I signed it.
You actually sent it to me, yes.
Wonderful.
And for our listeners who don't know already, you have a crowdfunding campaign going right now for a new book called Who Killed Nezzy?
Yeah, Nessie indeed. It is taking up most of my time at Zoop. It's not Zoom, but Zoop. And what a tremendous name for a company. I think that's really, really lovely. It's sort of...
It's very whimsical.
It is. It's like a special effect in comics for a thing that we do not yet know is required. It perhaps should be the noise Cyclops' eye blasts make, but it is not.
That's great.
I mean, it's probably something that Jack Kirby used at some point, because he used every sound effect. Mm. And even some that aren't possible.
Absolutely.
So, to get us started, as our listeners know, we have been working our way through Captain Britain and MI-13, which was a series that you wrote starting in, it was what, 2009? 2008? Somewhere in there?
2008 sounds right, because it comes out of Secret Invasion, so...
Right.
2008 sounds right. So, first off, I guess the question is, how did this series come about?
I was asked off the back of Wisdom, the miniseries, to... They very much had already planned that there was going to be a Captain Britain book as part of Secret Invasion, and so I was asked to be the one to do it. And, yeah, I was delighted. I've always wanted to write that character, and I had a ton of ideas for what I wanted to do with him. And so, yeah, it was... Having Marvel Britain to work with is always interesting, because it's a little bit cut off from the Marvel Universe. You know, depending on which bit of Marvel Britain you go to and in what era, it can be incredibly whimsical or a real horror fest. And it's got this slight distance. And for one thing I wanted to do, actually, was to bring it more in line with the rest of the universe, because Secret Invasion being a worldwide invasion, that did seem to, you know, give an opportunity to, you know, the Skrulls were invading Britain as well, and probably Belgium.
Sure. That actually sort of leads to a follow-up. So Marvel had envisioned some sort of Captain Britain tie-in off the bat as part of Secret Invasion.
That's my recollection. It may be wrong. My memory is not great.
What was it like launching a book as a tie-in in a crossover event? Like, were there certain restrictions or requirements that they had?
Yeah, they basically, this was going to be the magic book. So Greg Pak was dealing with the gods, and we would do the magic. And so, yeah, and hence, you know, the other world and everything spun out of that, really. And I think I suggested and invented the new characters and really pitched for who I wanted on the team. I didn't get everybody I was after. I can't remember who I couldn't get. And I think I wanted some lower key British Marvel characters that you know, they didn't think would play as big-time team members, like Motormouth. And, you know, people from the short-lived 90s Marvel UK boom. So a lot of whom show up later in the run.
Yeah. I did appreciate there were one or two splash pages during the battle scenes where you sort of get glimpses of them.
yeah. And John the Skrull turned out to be incredibly problematic. I'd invented him for Wisdom, but Marvel absolutely did not want to put him on a cover because they didn't want to attract the attention of the Beatles estate. And so we killed him off really quickly in order so that we wouldn't have to keep skipping around his existence. Mm. And and I was pleased to have him around, but I absolutely understood the reasons why, you know, he's not going to get a Marvel Encyclopedia entry of his own. And so that was the mission. And I invented Asia to kind of, because I wanted a point of view character, a newbie, and I very much wanted a Muslim Brit, and I wanted to represent the NHS. And I'd got to know a group of Muslim women as a result of going to a conference, a writer's conference, and I kept in touch with them and asked them all sorts of questions about Fasia. And those questions got way involved into superhero universe stuff, like what would be the Muslim equivalent of the cross to a vampire? Which they suggested the call to prayer from the minaret, which I think is terrific.
That's fascinating, yeah.
Yeah. And so that was a really interesting thread to play. And, oh, originally on the moon, it was going to be Dracula meeting with not Dr. Doom, but the Prime Minister of the time, David Cameron. And that got through several drafts before Marvel's lawyers went, no! And I was saying he absolutely is playing Dracula. He's listening to his offer, and then he's going to go back home and call MI-13 and tell them everything.
Right.
And he's there's not a negative word said about him, but they still didn't want to do it. And Sorry, he wasn't Prime Minister at the time. That was the thing. He was leader of the opposition.
Yeah.
Then we cut to Gordon Brown, the Prime Minister of the time, briefing MI-13, because the thing was Dracula trying to offer the leader of the opposition a deal, you know.
Right.
But didn't work. But the whole Doom stuff played really well, I thought, in the end.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And the idea that, you know, of course Dr. Doom is going to hate everything Dracula stands for, because Dracula is a historic persecutor of Doom's people.
Right.
And of course, Dracula isn't going to think of that.
Because Dracula sees Doom as sort of the modern-day version of himself.
Yeah.
Sort of on the line between the East and the West.
Fellow rulers, we should talk. You know, we can talk real politic.
Right.
He hasn't quite grasped Doom's complete certainty that there are no others beside Doom.
It reminded me a little bit of, and I forget what comic it was. It might have been Acts of Vengeance, maybe, but there's a comic where Red Skull tries to team up with Magneto, and Magneto just flips out and throws him in a hole and leaves him there, because Red Skull just didn't get that wasn't going to work.
There is a great line that you have in a later issue where you have Blade say, Dracula assumes that everyone is as racist as he is.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which, yes, that tracks. That tracks so well. And like when I read that scene, I thought to myself, oh, Dracula's an unrepentant racist. Okay, cool. This firmly places the film Blackula in the Marvel Universe.
Yeah, because, you know, historically that's what Vlad the Impaler stood for. That's what he was doing.
And that you had brought in sort of Muslim British culture as part of the book already,
yeah,
that sets up all kinds of conflicts between the vampires as well, which is yeah, really nice. I like the way that plays out.
Absolutely.
Quick question about that scene. Something I wondered, because the Marvel Wikis seemed, because Doom talks about training under an old enemy of yours, and the Marvel Wikis thinks that means that Dr. Doom traveled back in time and met Van Helsing. But no. I'm like, it's Cagliostro, right?
Yes, it's Cagliostro. I think my Marvel continuity stuff is too much. I did a whole issue to save a guy that Chris Claremont during his Man-Thing run had left stranded.
Yes.
And nobody cares. I mean...
No, I read that panel. I was like, he didn't. Wow. Wow. That is a incredibly deep cut, and I admire it.
Well, you know, I would look up what the connections are between these two characters, and, you know... I suppose it's a little bit old-fashioned. It's a little bit Roy Thomas-y of me, the feeling that they should mention stuff which probably naturalistically nobody would.
I would actually argue it's a little bit Mark Gruenwald of you. Bringing the deep continuity.
Going back to Faiza, the character you created for the series, for just a minute, Faiza is very much, to me, the breakout character of that run. And as both a viewpoint character for the reader, as sort of the human viewpoint in otherwise either very government bureaucracy or very superhero-y kind of things, but also just, I don't know, she's sort of a breath of fresh air compared to what normally gets introduced as the new young, not quite sidekick, but up-and-coming hero. I think she's great.
Oh, thank you. I loved doing her in The Black Knight. I think that's a... Mm-hmm. It's
their relationship is really charming.
I love doing romantic relationships in Marvel comics. It's a thread that doesn't get done enough. And, you know, it's always nice to when Rogue and Gambit are in that space, for example. And, you know, it's something that it always adds a depth, I think. And
that said, I did look at that relationship and go like, okay, that's not going to last.
Aww.
Dane's too messy. Dane is way too messy.
Yeah. And that is actually the thing, that none of this is going to last.
I know.
I mean, you've always got to have a certain mortality of character in your head to read any of the big two superhero runs, that, you know, all of this will pass.
Wait until one of Dane's exes shows up.
Right.
And it's like, oh.
One of his many.
Many.
He was the most complicated character to use. I mean... Basically, I got loads of fan responses saying, "Are you going to remember that E?" And
how
there's
can
so
you?
Much. There's so much.
He's one of those you characters can't. You have to pick a lane with him and just say, "This is what we're following."
Yeah,
like you can have the Ebony Blade, or you could have the fake Ebony Blade, or you could have the little necklace around his neck that turns into a sword and shield, or you could have a lightsaber, or.
Right.
And that's not getting into his personal life and who he's affiliated with and who he is friendly with.
And all I could do was to say it all happened.
Yes.
And, you know, we're not erasing anything. I was disappointed in the Marvel Strike Force game, of which I am a great player and fan, that they had a Black Knight show up and it's Sir Percy of Scandia? How likely is that? I mean,
not anyone's first choice, I don't think.
No.
There are other ones too, because there's the female one that was like a young master.
Mm-hmm. There's the villainous one.
Yeah.
Because they've done some time hopping with the Black Knight, and so we've seen other eras.
Yeah.
But I think Dane is always the Black Knight, if you're picking a singular.
Yeah. It's I think these things come in generational waves, because it's who's cool when you were a kid. And so the Black Knight was a statue when I read the Avengers Defenders War, and I was like, who is that? And the mindless ones in my Birmingham run are there because I so loved them in the Ditko comics I read in
the
weekly.
They have such a distinctive look.
And there's something terrifically basic about them, that they just blast away.
I can see them being constructed like a villain from an 80s Doctor Who serial. You know, like they have that look with a little bit rubbery, sort of formless.
They are rubbery, yes.
I don't know. The rereading that Hell Comes to Birmingham arc, that sort of struck me, that these don't feel out of place marching through the streets of Britain.
Right. And I still get people really liking Captain Midlands.
Yeah.
Because those middle British cities are completely unrepresented otherwise in Marvel. And, you know, it's nice to have... I mean, he's a little bit of a joke character, but at the same time, he's got a serious arc and a kind of tragic dimension to him. And, yeah, people really like him.
Yeah,
and,
he's sympathetic, even. And you don't lose sight of... I think the good intentions, even as they lead to this betrayal.
Right. I mean, that's the wonderful thing about these three arcs of Captain Britain, that there are individual panels that people keep stumbling on in British culture and sending to me or putting up on social media. And that's incredibly satisfying.
Well, of course, the way to hand wave why they're so underrepresented is just imagine in the Marvel Universe, Midsummer Murderer's got a higher episode order, and so they're all dead.
There are lots of places that are vastly underrepresented in the Marvel Universe, basically anywhere in the States between the two coasts.
Right.
And even Los Angeles isn't very much.
No.
I will say, when I read Helga Inferno, I was shocked that Plakta was an original creation. He seems so Ditko.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
the name is precisely chosen because it echoes Ditko, but it's not mine. It's the name still, I believe, of a British science fiction fanzine.
Wow.
But it just always struck me as such a Ditko-esque name. And so they were quite, you know, they were willing to let me use it. And yeah, it is like Triborrow or... Yeah. Thank you.
The whole concept is great. Well, but that sort of gets to something we've talked about separately, but I'm going to try and put these two pieces together. The book draws on sort of deep cuts of mythology and continuity in the Marvel Universe, but it's also weaving in characters and concepts that are very much a part of specifically British culture.
Oh, yeah.
And so can you talk a little bit about how you sort of balanced those aspects of the book?
Well, I am often really quite annoyed about how Captain Britain is treated in the Marvel Universe. I think there's a level of disrespect that you simply wouldn't get for somebody like Captain America. And he had become known in fan culture as an alcoholic, having been seen drunk twice during Excalibur and having immediately stopped it as soon as his friends called him out on it in the way that alcoholics can't. And so the very first thing I wanted to do was to show him having a beer and that's okay. He's been deconstructed so much. He's never really been constructed since Chris Claremont constructed him. He was Alan Moore's earliest deconstruction in a wonderful way. But, you know, British being a post-colonial, post-imperial society, we're very much about deconstructing ourselves. We haven't got to the bottom yet. So we're not about to start moving upwards anytime soon. And British writers handling Captain Britain are equally keen to take him apart. And I just thought, let's construct him for once. Let's try and make a modern Captain Britain that works. And one of the reasons that I got rid of that Alan Davis costume is brilliant, but one of the reasons I got rid of the full face mask is that it's really difficult to portray emotion through it. You've got to make him slightly have that masked face portray emotion. And if I wanted a really realistic look for him, I wanted to get rid of the mask. And so, hence the new costume. I wanted him to be about confidence, that his power is based on confidence, because I think that's a very British thing. And also, I just had this scene, and I'm glad that sort of stayed. That's kept with the character since. One counts as victories, the little things in a shared universe, the little things that stay that you've created. And the origin scene, as it were, where the flags come from all parts of Britain and wrap around him, I very much, that was in my head from the start. And, yeah, I just wanted to say that standing for Britain is not necessarily a bad thing if one takes on board all the caveats and processes them and uses them. And, yeah, so hence my Captain Britain. And also putting Pete Wisdom beside him to be kind of the opposite, the cynical, that was really important to me. And also because I love Pete. He's kind of... He's my Mary Sue, you know. And I thought, it's not the 80s anymore. How about we get him out of the John Constantine trench coat? And thus I thought, let's do the opposite. Let's put him into some really nice fashions. Make him a dandy. And, you know, this is the basics, really, of how I do comics. You know, you react. You are in conversation with your genre. You react to what has come before.
Britain really does have a deep... lineup, a deep roster of superheroes, half of them spurred by Chris Claremont's Anglophilia.
Absolutely. thank goodness for Chris Claremont's Anglophilia.
Yes. And that he was evidently watching Doctor Who on PBS.
Oh, hugely. I mean, Alastair Stewart, for goodness sake. And I tried to plug in as much stuff as possible. I even gave the occasional hint that Alastair was going to turn into Ahab in the future scenario. But the sheer number of secret organizations in Marvel Britain. I have a scene where they sort of say that they're all the same one under different names after. one is named subsequent names for the same thing.
Yeah, but I think later writers like have some of the characters cross over, like the Men on the Wall and like all that sort of thing.
Yeah, the members of Strike were part of the initial setup of Orkis, which I was wondering what the hell that was. You know, what, did they need some British secret agents circling the sun out there? I don't know. I bet Hickman had a really specific thought about it, though. I mean,
probably.
Yeah.
He usually does. So, like, has there ever been any talk of, like, revisiting this corner, having you revisit this corner of the Marvel Universe?
Well, I recently did a little bit in that I wrote the novelization of Secret Invasion, the comic, not the TV show, for Titan. It's a hardback novel which came out late last year. And it was great fun to do, and I got to write new stuff for a bunch of my characters because it reiterates the battle on Westminster Bridge and Pete coming out of Otherworld and all that. So that was a great pleasure.
Well, I'm picking that up now.
I'll have to check that out because I always enjoy the sort of prose reimaginings of comics events.
I was incredibly pleased to do it, and it does the main miniseries and also a bunch of the branch offs to make one single narrative. And we keep going a little way after the miniseries to get to a good ending.
Sure. Sure.
One of the things that you do very well in the Secret Invasion crossover, I think, and it's something that Chris Claremont did during Inferno as well with almost the same characters, is like you have the title almost reproduce the crossover in its entirety in a much smaller stage.
Yeah, it's sort of a microcosm of the event. Yeah. So that it is very much a part of the event, but it is just isolated enough that you get to tell your own story.
Right, because I was doing a thematic bit of it, so I figured the thematic bit should have basically the same, you know, what happens with magic, you know, and yeah, and also I thought I gave it a proper ending and kind of shaped it, to blow my own trumpet. I'm loved Leonard's work on those issues. He's got a life to his art, which I remember we had a fight scene on a single page where I said, well, you know what the stakes are here, you know what emotions we're trying to portray, give me a fight scene. And he did 16 panels. I would never write 16 panels. But he's still a really underrated artist and amazing superhero artist.
Absolutely. The other thing that always comes to mind anytime, especially the something like Secret Invasion with the sort of throwback sci-fi alien invasion story, is Quatermass, right? Always a little bit of that sort of in the background of things.
There's getting away from it is the difficulty. I mean, it's as soon as you're in Britain and doing anything of the fantastical, Nigel Neal will be in the DNA.
Right. One question, not Marvel related, but I mentioned as we were starting, I was a big fan of Saucer Country from the beginning. And to me, that book was one of the highlights from that last hurrah of Vertigo before DC finally shut it down. And that it managed to hang on and that you were able to finally give it an ending. So congratulations first on being able to complete that crowdfunding campaign. But also, can you talk a little bit about that experience of continuing a book across three different publishers?
My goodness, it was such a haul. I mean, I really wanted to finish that story because I thought it was just becoming more and more relevant as time went on. I mean, our plot was about Russian interference in American elections before it happened. And the after being initially cancelled at Vertigo, Chris Ryle went to IDW and commissioned me and Ryan for a 12 issues which would finish it. And after six, we were doing a natural break to let Ryan recover. And Chris left IDW, and we found ourselves without a patron and cancelled again. And so I realised after a while, well, I was going to start a new plot in those last six issues. How much space do I really need to finish it? And I figured out I could do it in a single issue. There's only a little lectury. Vladimir Putin delivers a two-page lecture on the history of the intelligence organisations and UFOs at one point.
Which, frankly, seems a little in character for him.
But I don't think it's as lectury as you might think. And so I was delighted to be able to say to Zoop, you know, this will really suit Zoop, because there's very little new material required, but we could do a really nice collected edition that actually, you know, sorts out a few typos. And Ian Chalgren, the designer on that, was terrific. He's done two entirely different editions, one for Zoop and one for when Chris Ryle's Syzygy company brings it out in autumn in a bookstore edition, because we wanted the Zoop backers to get something that nobody else would.
Sure.
And it was also really important to us that the finale on its own would be available, so that people who'd been loyal and bought every issue up until now could just get the ending and didn't have to buy a huge book. So Ryan went through hell during the drawing of those last 20 pages. I'm not at liberty to say what happened in his life, but it's truly stuff that should never happen to a human being. And yet he delivered some of his best work, I think. And, you know, I'm blown away by that man's talent and commitment. And one of the best artists I've ever worked with. And we've got to that point where I know what his art is going to look like, and he can read my intentions early. That's a wonderful feeling. I mean, he's up there with I Walk with Monsters. This is ridiculous. I'm forgetting everything these days. Sally Cantarino, the great Sally Cantarino, who, you know, is also has superpowers in terms of acting and sensing the writer's intent. But so love it. I'm relieved and delighted it's over. It's done. My story
is
out there in the world.
That it came out. It's a gorgeous book. It looks great. The writing is, frankly, prescient in a lot of ways. I was rereading the early issues before reading the finale, and it just struck me how time had only made it more relevant.
Thank you.
It's always great when art can do that.
I do think that we sold it to the audience wrong at the start. I think they were actually expecting aliens to genuinely show up.
And, like they wanted, like, Independence Day.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, that's our fault for not managing expectations. But, yeah, anyway, that was delightful.
And so that was the first half of our interview with Mr. Paul Cornell. Thank you again to Mr. Cornell for joining us. We hope you enjoyed that first part of the interview. To hear the second part of the interview, make sure you tune in to our next episode, where we will be discussing the third and final story arc of Captain Britain MI-13, Vampire State.
And of course, you can always find us. You can email us. Our email address is tombofideas@gmail.com. We're on social media, most places. We're on Blue Sky at Tomb of Ideas, Instagram at Tomb of Ideas, Facebook, facebook.com/Tomb of Ideas. We are still technically on that other website, but you may have noticed we don't post a lot over there anymore, and there's good reason for that. If you want to find us, interact with us, go sign up for Blue Sky now. It's open to everybody.
That's true. And of course, our entire back catalog is found on cinepunks.com. That's cinepunks with an X. All of our shows are there, along with other great podcasts like The Carnage Report, Cinema Smorgasbord, the flagship Cinepunks podcast. And so make sure you check out all the great stuff at cinepunks.com.
That's right. And until next time, two believers.
Bye-bye.
You have been listening to The Tomb of Ideas, a Marvel horror podcast. Until next time, Tombers.
Excelsior!